Episode 9, Part 3. The State's Facade of Honor and Benevolence. Critical thinking question, what's it hiding? In other words, what emerges from behind that facade to confront people who've dared to stand up and call it a facade? What emerges to confront people who apparently have, I don't know, missed the most important messages of public education? That you're supposed to be obedient to authority, and that you are supposed to conform or fit yourself into predictable and easily manageable groups. But have also missed perhaps the most important lesson, that if those two types of training fail, you are still expected to remain indifferent and apathetic to what's going on. You're supposed to feel as if you are only one person, and what could you possibly do to affect any kind of meaningful change? What lurks behind that facade, ready to confront people who realize that all of these lessons are total nonsense? To confront people who have decided that they're supposed to be free, and they've also decided to start acting like it.
Government man, spend his politics till they've got you pinned. Everybody trying to reach out to each other, but they don't know where to begin. I said, how come I can't tell the free world from living hell? I said, how come? How come all I see?
Mass murder. Torture, deception, theft, kidnapping. We learn, or we are trained, to call many of these things by different names when they're being done by certain people. We call theft taxation. We call mass murder defense. We call kidnapping incarceration and justice. But even if we do kind of start to pick up the hint that theft is just theft, and mass murder is just mass murder, and kidnapping is just kidnapping, there's another rationalization available to most people to try and quiet that voice telling them that this is really, really wrong. It's usually called something like the common good, the national interest, sometimes the greater good, a vague, amorphous, and apparently very flexible concept that can be used to justify all of these horrors. If you're a believer in this concept called the common good, I'd like to invite you to try a little experiment. The first thing you're going to want to do is open up your schedule going forward, probably a few days, if not a few weeks, because there's quite a few steps involved. The first thing that you should try to do is get 5 of your friends together and tell them that you're planning on ordering a pizza, and then get them to come to a unanimous decision about what the toppings on that pizza should be. If you're able to do this in a somewhat expedient way, next, try to get them to come to a unanimous decision about how children should be educated. If you're able to accomplish this in a somewhat expedient way, then get them to come to a unanimous decision about how this mass of land should be defended from foreign invaders or kept safe from vague but haunting-sounding nouns like terrorism and communism. And make sure you include the little details like all the steps that should be taken, all the steps that should be avoided, budgets, personnel. Just make sure you cover all your bases. And if you are able to bring 5 people to a consensus on pizza toppings, education, and defense, you're probably looking at a pretty close-knit group of friends. So at this point, you can go ahead and try it with a few more things. Transportation and infrastructure, construction standards, urban development, protection of the environment, healthcare, traffic safety, dispute resolution, protection services, currency, banking practices, how relationships with people living on other masses of land should be maintained or strengthened, trade,
even give it a try with things that these people don't know anything about and have never even really thought of, like how agriculture should work, energy conservation, nuclear reactor production, radioactive waste disposal. And don't forget to cover exactly what should be done to help people who are less fortunate. And if you are able to bring these five people to a unanimous decision about every single thing that, I don't know, the government is involved in, congratulations. You've proven the existence of a common good for five people. But you're not done yet. Now, repeat the experiment with 10 people. And if you once again find yourself successful, repeat the experiment with 20 people, and then 40 people. But long before the point where you're looking for 40 friends to round up to try this with, you will have found that the experiment was a complete failure. Probably right around the time that the original five people were trying to decide what the second topping on the pizza should be. But strangely enough, there are thousands of people in America and around the world today, and there have been these types of people throughout time, who believe that they can successfully complete this experiment. And not just for 5, 10, 20, or 40 people, but millions of people. And people who are not their friends, people who they don't even know. This is a sign of madness. And these people are extremely dangerous. And you should do whatever you can possibly do to limit your interactions with them.
And I talked about this in an earlier episode of School Sucks podcast, when I said if you encounter a person on the street who comes up to you and claims to have some kind of special ability where they can decide what's good or what's beneficial for huge groups of people that they've never even met and don't know anything about, turn your back to that person and run. But unfortunately, and perhaps even tragically, throughout history, there have been these organizations that demented people like the ones that I'm talking about have been able to get themselves into. And because of the structure of the organization, it makes it incredibly difficult for people like us to turn our back and run away from them. And running parallel to these organizations throughout history have been groups of people who wanted to free themselves from what they saw as excessive control or oppression laid upon them by these organizations. Unfortunately, and perhaps again, even tragically, the tactic that is usually used to accomplish this is the same tactic that the organization itself relies upon: violence. And because, as we've talked about before, violence has such unpredictable and perverse unintended consequences, the people often find themselves, within a decade or perhaps even a generation, somehow transformed into the very type of organization that they were once fighting against. Sometimes they're even worse. If you'd like a historical example of this, go to Wikipedia and type in the United States of America. But now, in the 21st century, in the very state that I grew up in and now live in once again, something very interesting and exciting has recently started to happen just within the last few years. It's called the Free State Project, and right now I think it is safe to say that the center of the project's activities is in the western part of the state in the city of Keene, New Hampshire. On a side note, I'm actually planning my first trip to Keene in over 10 years tomorrow. The activism going on in Keene could be described as thoughtful, peaceful, and educational steps that are being taken to expose for all to see exactly what is hiding behind that facade that I was talking about at the beginning of the show. And sorry to completely ruin the suspense, but what's behind that facade of honor and benevolence that organization that I've been talking about, the state,
puts up is violence. And the activists in Keene have done so far a phenomenal job of exposing it.
But because I'm not personally involved in what's going on out in Keene, which is about 100 miles away from where I am, yet anyway, I will keep my statements about the Free State Project and the activism that's going on in the western part of the state brief. And instead, I will suggest a number of resources that I believe are worth checking out. The first is the radio talk show and internet podcast Free Talk Live that I've mentioned a couple of times before. You can also, for video, check out the Obscured Truth Network, which is a YouTube channel and website documenting the interactions that these activists have with the so-called justice system. A similar YouTube channel on website is the Ridley Report, which is a more general documentation of the activism and activity going on in Keene and Manchester. The publication, New Hampshire Free Press, which is also a website, the website freekeene.com, and there's also a forum on the Free Talk Live page that talks about many of these issues as well. Another person I could not find a website for, but definitely worth a quick Google or YouTube search, is Lauren Canario. Lauren spelled exactly how you would expect, Canario, C-A-N-A-R-I-O. And she, from what I've read, heard, and seen about her, is a really amazing and brave activist in New Hampshire as well. I wanted to organize a roundtable with a number of these people, but I was unable to coordinate that in time. This is really kind of a down-to-the-wire before I leave for 7 days to travel podcast. But luckily, I was able to get in touch with one of the pioneering movers to the Keene area, as far as activism is concerned. Keene has actually been settled for quite some time. And somebody who's been, I think it's safe to say, one of the most prolific activists in the last few years, Kat Canning, who also runs the New Hampshire Free Press. And she is my guest today to talk about the Free State Project, the activism in Keene, and her experiences. And one of the exciting things about this Free State Project and this activism in Keene is that the first time I remember listening to Free Talk Live, maybe in 2006, they were talking about a small group of activists that included Kat, Lauren, and Kat's husband, Russell, and not too many others. And now it seems like those are three names in a sea of names of people who have since come to the Keene area and have begun demonstrating that the government school's training in obedience and apathy doesn't work for everybody. And like I said, I'm a little rushed as far as putting this production together is concerned, so I have to take a few shortcuts. And I actually think that these will work out quite well. I'm going to sandwich my interview with Kat between two audio clips that are both from videos, both from the Ridley Report. Dave Ridley is a documentarian who documentarianates the activities that are going on in between Keene and Manchester, New Hampshire. And the incident that he's going to be discussing was an IRS tax office protest that actually, the original incident was some 2 years ago, where he was arrested and then Kat participated in basically a protest of his arrest doing something very similar to what he had done, I think, just the day before. The video is actually from a year after this incident when Kat was being threatened with federal charges for what she did. And the clip at the end will be another edition of the Ridley Report when Ridley was released after a brief stay in jail. And I also just want to point out that the Ridley Report is a very good production. The audio quality on the first clip I'm going to play is not really representative of his typical quality of work, but the second piece is just fine. And of course, as usual, I'll make sure that all of these things are linked in the show notes on Podomatic. And until next time, hey, you know what? Happy Thanksgiving. Take care.
This June 6th supplementary edition of the Ridley Report is brought to you by Sinkle CAI, the company that collects with respect. Now, I want to report to you that it appears Kat Canning has been threatened with arrest by the Fed. This in connection to her demonstration in an IRS office a year ago. She sat in an office in support of me, actually. She and Lauren were both briefly arrested at the time, back in July 07, because they sort of were acting in support of me. I was arrested for petitioning inside an IRS office, but handing out leaflets to government workers at the IRS lobby in Nashua. And in support of me, almost within 2 days, I think it was within 2 days of me being arrested on that charge, they went and did the same thing to show that the more arrests they make, the more arrests they'll have to make. And
but they refused to attend their trials. And the Fed just kind of walked away from it for a while, apparently. But now they have issued an arrest warrant for Kat, and she will, again, not attempt to attend trial or turn herself in, but she will make, I think, her location known. You know, she's going to be at the federal courthouse outside it to demonstrate around June 16th. But anyway, this is just a real brief synopsis of what's going on. I'm going to put a video description in the clip eventually. That you can come back if you don't see if you don't see a link in the video description, then there will be one there eventually that will take you to the NH3.com thread where this is being discussed in detail. But anyway, Kat Canning threatened with arrest by the Fed, warrant signed by Marshal Monier, Steve Monier himself. We'll see what happens with this. This is Dave Ridley signing out for RidleyReport.com, brought to you by SACL CAI. Sinkle is really three companies in one. They do early out billing, they also do collections, and they do charged off receivables. But the most important thing to know about Sinkle is that they treat your customers with respect. They know you don't just want your money back. You want to keep your customers too. Sinkle CAI, they collect with respect.
Sinkle CAI, Sinkle CAI.
I'm being joined by Kat Canning, the editor of the New Hampshire Free Press, Free State Project member, and Liberty activist. How are you today, Kat?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I have heard your name mentioned quite a bit over the last couple of years with the Free State Project and activism for liberty in New Hampshire in general. So I wanted to invite you on today to discuss what's going on in Keene and in the rest of the state. And the other thing, too, is if I remember correctly, I've heard them talk about you on Free Talk Live. I recall quite a few incidents involving you and law enforcement. And I just wanted to start with a little bit of a strange question. How much time would you say that in your life you've spent behind bars?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. And that did that result from hurting any other person or damaging somebody else's property?
No.
Interesting. So what were the circumstances?
I went into an IRS office. I was protesting torture in Guantanamo. I was holding a sign that said taxes pay for torture. They didn't appreciate it. They had me arrested.
So do they have you arrested basically to have you removed from that location, but do they give you any kind of an attempt at a rationalization for throwing somebody in jail for not being violent or not damaging property or anything like that?
Not really. They wanted me to pay a fine. I refused to pay the fine, so they put me in jail instead.
Did they charge you with something?
Disobeying an officer.
Disobeying an officer.
So they told me to leave, and I didn't leave.
So you disobeyed.
Mm.
Well, that's interesting. In a nation of laws, like when I express my views to people who are not like-minded, we'll say, they always tell me that we live in a nation of laws, and that's supposed to give me some kind of comfort and security knowing that. But it seems like, from my experience and from what I've heard other people say, the law pretty much seems to be whatever they say it is, because a cop can tell you anything, or any kind of government law enforcement official can tell you anything, and if you don't comply, you've apparently broken a law, failure to obey.
Yeah, that's been my experience. Just a couple of days ago in Manchester, a guy was hassled by the police. I think they wanted to charge him with disobeying an officer. He decided to open carry a rifle while he was sitting in the park, and the police came and told him to leave. And since he didn't obey that supposedly lawful order, then he got thrown in jail.
And when it also seems like there, it doesn't just end there. Like, if we go to court, let's say, and we don't do exactly what the judge asks of us, or in some cases we're not even courteous and polite as the judge would like us to be, again, he can just say that, or whoever the judge is, can just say that we're in contempt of court. So it it basically just seems like the law, this nation of laws that's supposed to make us feel safe and comfortable, is really up to whoever the people are wearing the badges or the robes.
That's so true. Like Ian Freeman, he was told to sit down, and he didn't sit down fast enough, so the judge threw him in jail. It was going to be for quite a while, but... got let out.
Yeah, yeah. And that was about a year ago. And I know that there was another event recently, and we talked about this in our run through yesterday, about another gentleman who was jailed for 6 months, was it?
Yeah, he's in right now for 6 months.
And what was the reason for that? That's a pretty a long time in jail.
I think he asked a flippant question in court, and the judge was, this is the same judge we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
In Ian Freeman's case, he was ticked off and sentenced him to jail and for contempt for 6 months for asking a question.
So, what is considered to be a flippant question for from the point of view of the man with the robe on?
I guess anything that makes him look bad. Kurt. I don't actually know what the question was yet.
But was this the gentleman, or are we actually even talking about a different person now, who wanted the judge to basically extend the same courtesy to him as the defendant that the judge expects the defendant to show to the judge?
Right.
So yeah. He was asked to stand, and he requested that the judge be polite and say please, which I think... You know, even though that's a completely reasonable request, if you are going to say something like that to a judge, you do have to have your schedule cleared, unfortunately, at least for the next couple weeks. Because we were actually just talking about this maybe a couple weeks back on the Complete Liberty podcast, Wes Bertrand show, and some of this civil disobedience, or even not what would be considered civil disobedience, but just being curious and expressing that curiosity to people in law enforcement, if you are going to go down that path, you really need to make sure you have an open schedule. Because I think the story was Daniel Lockemacher, who does the show with us, was talking about getting pulled over in Ohio, and he had a lot of questions for the state trooper, who came up and shined a flashlight in his eye and said, "Who are you?" And Daniel said, "Well, who are you? And why are you doing this? And why is this happening?" You know, I think certainly fair questions, but my response was I had just been pulled over, within the last couple of weeks as well, okay, for an inspection sticker, which is, as we all know, the sticker that holds our car together. If the sticker is not there, you are a major rolling hazard if that $25 sticker is not affixed to your windshield. So, my response to Daniel was, you know, I think that it's great that you did that and you had the time and the courage to do that, and it makes for an entertaining story because the police certainly don't expect that. But in my situation, I just didn't have the time. I had somewhere I needed to be, because there's 100 questions you could ask a cop about an inspection sticker.
You know, my husband had something interesting to say this morning about our whole movement, the civil disobedience and all, that it's not really non-cooperation with this evil government.
Mm-hmm.
it's, in reality, it's really hard to completely not cooperate with them. But reducing your cooperation, you know?
Reducing?
Yes. So if everybody's just irritating them a little, it's going to add up and be a real problem for them, you know?
Yeah.
Somebody's not sitting in court or standing for the judge. And it all adds up to be, no, we really don't like you guys.
Right. And it's you're absolutely right. And that's a good point that he made, because if you think about how pervasive the state is and just all of the things that it sticks its hands or sticks its fists into, you realize that to live completely free is virtually today impossible. You in some way or another have to, at some point, and for a lot of people, it's in small ways every day, but you have to surrender your time, your money, or in a lot of unfortunate cases, your freedom to these individuals calling themselves government, because they are everywhere and they're in everything. And I'm really not a big fan of the news, but from the whiffs of news that I get about what's going on in places, not just in Concord, but in Washington, it seems mm-hmm. like this is not something that's going to be going away either. It seems like this is really, over the last 10 years, but now really, really over the last year, has been ratcheted up and ratcheted up. So it's certainly 10 years ago or 50 years ago, the time was right for what you guys were doing. But I think now it's absolutely essential in New Hampshire and beyond.
Yeah, everybody doing what they can, you know. Not everybody's brave enough to go to jail, but the police were hassling me the other day. I was just sitting in a parking lot waiting for the bank to open, and they decided I must be a bank robber.
What town was that in where that happened?
Lebanon.
Okay, would you say that you are a person of interest to the Lebanon police?
It's possible. I was certainly on the list once in Lebanon because of the issue with Edling Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I didn't get the impression that he knew who I was when he was hassling me. Somebody doing something unusual, and like the woman sitting next to me in the parking lot, I guess called the police because I was sitting there waiting for the bank to open.
It's tough when you live in those kind of small towns too, that for some reason have I don't know what the police force is like in Lebanon, but I live in Newmarket, New Hampshire, which is probably I'm not sure, maybe 10,000-15,000 people in the greater Newmarket area, and not a lot goes on here, and the police really have to kind of hunt for ways to keep themselves busy. I think that's something that's characteristic of small towns that have sizable police forces, is they're bored and they're often looking for something to do.
Yeah, that's the case here. But he demanded ID from him, and I said no.
Right.
I'm not doing anything. I said, can I leave? And he said yes. And, you know, he was really mystified why I was getting so mad at him. It's like, well, I'm minding my own business here.
And part of the mystery on the officer's part is, why is this person just not sort of tacitly obeying everything I say? That's part of it too, I would think, right?
Yeah. So then he followed me around town. I think he must have gotten a clue from all the bumper stickers, you know, the state project. Like, oh, I'm dealing with one of them.
Right. So now you're a person of interest to this officer, because certainly he knows of this Free State project. I know Lebanon is not too far away from Keene, so maybe, I mean, not that there's any kind of justification for that at all, but that's interesting, and I think that whenever I hear people tell these stories about showing police officers anything less than 100% obedience, there's two reactions that are most common. The first is just sort of they're stunned. They don't get it.
Right.
And the second would probably be anger, you know, like really kind of ratcheting up
the level of the interrogation or the it becomes a more serious interaction when a person is not just completely obedient with their every demand. I think that that's what they expect from most people, because sadly, that's how most people are.
That's been my experience. Mostly, as soon as you say the word no, then they're all ramped up and ready to bust in ahead.
Mm-hmm.
This guy took it really well. He was just kind of mystified. Like, what the heck?
Yeah, so that actually provides us an interesting segue there, because on my podcast, for the last several episodes, I've been exploring what I believe to be an embedded or hidden sort of poisonous curriculum within public education. And obviously the most essential lesson that I think we all pick up in school, essential to those in power or those looking to exercise power over people, is obedience, is basically blind obedience. And the second is conformity, the need to fit into a group, the need to not stick out, to not rock the boat. And that scales up nicely to the adult world in the form of collectivism, people attaching their identity to groups or to symbols of those groups and sort of sacrificing their individuality. But both conformity and obedience are things that we could pick up in a number of different places. I think conformity could stem or could result just from the social pressures of growing up, and obedience can certainly come from places like religion or family in many ways, depending on the family, depending on the religion, of course. But the third lesson that we're actually in the process of talking about now on the show is this sort of inculcation of apathy and indifference. And this is an extremely unnatural condition for people. That obedience can come from different places, conformity can come from different places, but people losing that childhood curiosity, all of those how and why questions that we all have when we're little, when that has vanished from most people, it's a good indication that something extremely unnatural has taken place. And the question that I had really for you, because I thought you were a person who had a lot of experience with this, just from what I've heard in places like Free Keen and Free Talk Live, is that plenty of people break out of obedience. They break out of just sort of being blindly obedient to anything that presents itself as authority. So that's kind of a bubble that they burst out of, and then they have to deal with this conformity problem. I'm developing disobedient ideas, but I still don't really want to rock the boat or stick out too much, so then they have to break out of that bubble. But the people like yourself and the people in Keene and many of the activists involved in the Free State Project have kind of broken a third bubble, which is apathy and indifference. Like, oh, yeah, this is all bad, but I'm just one person and I can't do anything. And that's not what people in Keene or most people involved in the Free State Project are saying. They're saying, I am doing something. Mm-hmm. So the question that I have is, another lesson that we get in school is how benevolent and how wonderful and how essential the state is and how it's there to do good, the greater good and for the people. But that's very much a facade. And this is a long question, but here's basically what I'm asking. What have you found from your personal experience or your experience knowing the Browns or being in the Keene area, what emerges from behind that facade to confront people who are not only disobedient and nonconformist, but have stopped being apathetic, who have decided that they're supposed to be free and they're going to start acting like they're free?
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly see the fist behind the pretty facade really quickly.
Mm.
Elaine Brown, a dentist, certainly a very nice lady. She's now behind bars for life because she stood up to them and said, no, you don't have a right to my money. And now they've slammed her hard. They wanted to make an example of her and Ed. And
when you say slammed her, what was the consequence? What was the ultimate decision as far as Elaine Brown is concerned?
Well, they gave her initially for the tax stuff. I think it was 8 years in jail. Mm-hmm. And then there was all this other stuff that had to do with them being holed up in their house and supposedly fleeing from justice and trying to protect themselves while they were in their house, that they gave her something like 30 or 40 more years. But, you know, she's 60 some odd years. And so that amounts to a life sentence for her.
So bizarre, too, how certainly I think everyone can understand how the thoughts we have in our head become our words. But isn't it interesting how our words also have a way of becoming our thoughts? Because people would swallow hook, line, and sinker the idea that these people are running from the word justice, uh-huh. where justice is a group of strangers who do not care about the Browns, who are trying to seize their property for no other reason besides another group of strangers who didn't know or care about the Browns, wrote something down on paper 80 years ago that said it was okay for this group of violent strangers to do that. And people say, oh, yeah, justice. Okay, yeah, that makes sense, and never even really look at it any closer than that. But I think that that's absolutely horrible, that this woman never hurt anybody in her life. I mean, think about all of the people that she probably helped and all of the people who found her to be a wonderful person. I've seen the sort of follow-up posts on articles about the Browns, and a lot of the people are just completely awful, like they got what they deserve. But there's some people who write in there and say, I knew this woman. She was an absolutely wonderful woman, and this is horrible what's happened to her. That people would call that justice. Isn't that bizarre?
It's even amazing what she's doing now. She's in prison for life, mm-hmm. and she's doing everything she can to help our other prisoners. And she's, I believe, teaching reading, and she's, they may be letting her do dental work in there.
Yep.
For like $1 a month, we could pay.
Well, what was the outcome for Mr. Brown, for Ed Brown?
So he got the same 8 years, and right now he's in a mental institute. I hate to think what they're doing to him, shooting him up with some sort of drug. He's being evaluated for sanity before they sentence him for the additional charges.
Mm. And that, from what I've known, and I've worked in education for a long time, but a lot of that time had a mental health component to it as well, where I was dealing with kids who were basically wards of the state, who were basically in state custody. And you know, what I realized is that if people think that children are treated badly when they're being held by the government 35 hours a week, you should see how they're treated when they are, the government is their guardian. And the mental health, state hospitals, state mental hospitals is in many cases, from what I've read and from what I've seen, a far worse sentence than prison can be in a lot of cases. So, yeah, my sympathy really, really goes out to both Ed and Elaine Brown. And I think that in the last couple of years, that situation has provided one of the clearest examples of what the state really is and what the state really does. But I know that you probably have a few others, and I would just kind of open it up for you to share anything else that comes to mind.
Yeah, my own experience questioning them. I guess the first time I was arrested in Manchester, Bush came to town.
Mm.
And I had some sort of sign about tyrants, and the Secret Service didn't appreciate it and had me arrested and Russell. So that was just to get us out of there right then, so the president's delicate eyes wouldn't be offended by my sign.
Now, was this before the day of what they call now call free speech zones, where they take some of that orange construction fencing and they rope off a little area where people can have rights?
or was that after that?
Yeah, that was the problem. I was refusing to stand in the free speech zone.
Which I'm guessing is probably a safe distance away from anybody that you would actually want to view the sign.
Right.
I see. So your own experience, we talked about the Browns, we talked about Ian Freeman, we talked about yourself a little bit, and I know yesterday your husband Russell has also had a multitude of run-ins with law enforcement in New Hampshire as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's true.
How much time has he spent behind bars?
It probably adds up to 3 months.
3 months, and... Same follow-up question. No victims, no property damage, I assume, right?
That's true.
And what was an incident that put him behind bars for any lengthy period of time?
Well, his first one was he tried to go through the airport TSA line without showing ID and without getting patted down.
Mm-hmm.
And all he carried with him was, I think he had a Bible. That was it.
Yeah.
There might have been a constitution in there, too. So they came and arrested him. That was kind of funny. The judge said, well, was there anything in the Bible that was dangerous? And they said no, and they let him go the next day.
What actually landed him in jail?
For that? They called that trespassing.
Trespassing. Interesting.
Yeah.
I think... we could talk about plenty of examples of, like 10 are coming to my mind right now of these people, mainly, I guess, in Keene, who have been jailed or detained even for something that's pretty ridiculous. But
yeah.
I know we were talking yesterday about the Free State Project a little bit and how a couple of years ago I had heard, maybe it was about a year ago, I heard somebody say that the Free State Project had not had this mandatory Rosa Parks moment that was necessary to show the entire country or show the entire world what was going on here. And I felt like that was a little bit of a miscalculation because the Rosa Parks story of this woman is very characteristic of the kinds of stories that we get in public education that work actually to disempower people. That Parks was a woman, this is the story that we get, who was tired one day, so all by herself decided that she wasn't going to go to the back of a bus in Alabama, and this basically kicked off. This was the trigger for the civil rights movement. When this story is completely fictional, Rosa Parks was part of well-organized groups of like-minded people who had planned these kinds of acts of civil disobedience. They knew what the consequences would be, and they were ready to accept them. But the way Rosa Parks is cast in history is as this lone revolutionary, and the message that translates to students is, this is not something that you could do. I mean, look at how brave this person was, and look at the circumstances of this. This is not something that ordinary people like you sitting in your desk reading a textbook are capable of. This was a sort of magical, special person in a unique moment in time. And when I think about what I've heard going on in Keene and Manchester, and what I've started to see recently, the groups of people that are even over here on the eastern side of the state, it really makes a huge difference when people can come together. I think you've found that to be true. Is that correct?
Yeah. Like we were saying earlier about increasing your resistance to government demands,
mm-hmm.
Not totally non-cooperating, but having people around each doing a little bit of non-cooperation, it encourages the others, oh, okay, I can take a step forward and not cooperate this little bit. And it tends to snowball everybody not cooperating a little bit more.
And would you say that the response from, government officials on any level has been more of, like, when we talk about the individual cop, either gets very very aggressive, or he's just completely blown away by anything that looks like disobedience. When we look at the larger picture, the entire Keene police force, or the legal apparatus in that area, or I don't want to call it the justice system, but the legal apparatus in the Keene area, has the response been okay? These people clearly are not responding to basic subtle threats, so we need to ratchet this up? Or has it been more like that confusion and uncertainty about what to do with Free State Project members?
That's what I've seen, is the confusion. You know, one day they'll have had a meeting and decide, okay, we're going to crack down.
Yep.
And they try that. And a whole bunch of more people start doing things and coming to Keene. So they think, oh, well, the crackdown isn't working. It's doing what they're saying. So it's bringing more of them. So we're going to just try to ignore their civil disobedience. So they ignore the 420 stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. But then, oh, they're going to do it at Pumpkin Festival. Oh, we can't have that. We got to crack down on
right.
them. Oh, when we crack down, more of them come. So, yeah. They're very confused.
Yeah, it seems that way from what I've picked up. And it's interesting, too, that I made the point a couple of times that people who would consider themselves to be philosophical libertarians, people who would consider themselves to be voluntarists, have a pretty powerful public relations organization hard at work for them every day, basically making their points for them, and that is the federal government of the United States. You could not get mm-hmm. better PR than that. But if you take that down to a local level, I think about what happened to Sam, who came up here from Texas, and within a matter of, I think it was weeks, if not a matter of months, was jailed for like 60-something days, if I remember correctly, for trying to videotape in a court lobby.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this guy who hasn't hurt anybody or damaged anything, sitting in jail, and you have a show like Free Talk Live that I assume reaches hundreds of thousands of people talking about it every day. Isn't the legal system in Keene and the Keene police and the people who did this, aren't they kind of by proxy doing public relations, doing advertising for the Free State Project and for this activism by doing something like that? I'm just singling out the example of Sam Dodson, but isn't that like the best PR that any kind of movement or effort of activism could ask for?
I think so. That judge who did this to Sam, who did this to Kurt, who did this to Ian, I gave him an award for Free State Project recruiting.
Yes.
And I stuck it on the wall in there, and they took it But imagine, I think they were annoyed.
I thought things had a lot of power when you, it was a piece of paper, I assume?
Oh, it was a little framed certificate.
Well, that sounds very official, because I thought that the walls of that building had some kind of magical power, where if you stuck paper to it, it became law, because wasn't that the situation that started with Sam? Somebody had just sort of arbitrarily posted a notice that suddenly there was no right that people who wanted to film in the lobby of this court suddenly could not do it, that the piece of paper was not signed by anybody. And when I think it was Sam and Dave Ridley, if I'm remembering the story correctly, you have to correct me if or certainly yeah. anybody listening in the future can correct me on any of this as well. But when they challenged that, that was basically what started this whole thing rolling. Is that correct?
Right.
Interesting. So the other question that I would have for you is basically because I am doing a show that has education as its main topic, but also how the education that we get from the government translates to the things that people who are liberty-minded or people who are voluntarists are pointing out about society that are wrong, that are clearly unjust. So one of the other questions that I have for you, and by the way, the links that you sent me about 101 reasons, I think it's actually 104 reasons now, to give up on public education was absolutely extraordinary. I only could get through 15 of them this morning before I called you, but I could really beef up my show notes for School Sucks podcast with a lot of that stuff. There was so much good information in there, so thanks for that. But based on what you've seen, what has been your approach to raising your own child? I know we talked and you said you had a daughter. So what have you done?
I've always homeschooled her. She's never been to any kind of school.
Right.
I just couldn't imagine putting her through what I went through in the public schools, and they're so much worse now. I've also tried to teach her to question, you know.
Yeah.
Even what I tell her.
Yeah. School seems to be very much about conclusions, like sort of prepackaged conclusions that are not to go too crazy with metaphors here, but they're just kind of these liquefied conclusions that students are expected to soak up like sponges and really never think about anything that they're being told. And why would they? It's incredibly mundane and boring and repetitive. So it's nice training for obedience and apathy as well. But you would your experiences in public education, if you were just to name a few, what was it about your experiences that you said, in addition to what you see from the state and what you've experienced in your interactions with government, what was it about public school that made you say, you know what, I'm not going to have my own child go through this?
The worst part of public school for me was the mind-numbingness of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love to read and learn, and still do, and just being forced to do the same things over and over and over again when I got it the first time just drove me mad. I just couldn't see subjecting my daughter to that.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. We talked about this yesterday. I used to be a history teacher in private school, but when I was a little bit younger, I thought that I could build a curriculum for American history basically out of textbooks, that I could use a textbook as a reference guide. And what I found after only a couple months in this first history teaching job that I had was that the textbooks were basically playing the same story over and over again. Like a chapter would start, the government, which is often called the people, in history textbooks, would encounter some kind of problem. By the end of the chapter, some heroic, noble visionary, I hope the sarcasm is coming through here a little bit, like Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, or Franklin Roosevelt, would find a way to solve the problem. People could kind of wipe their hands and go on to the next chapter. So it was basically, I think the way I summed it up yesterday was, some mystery show on television where, oh, there's some kind of mystery. All you have to do is sit there, and the people on the show will solve it for you in the next hour. So it's like history is just watching the same mystery television show over and over again, and I could see why young people would come to think that it is so excruciatingly boring. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not stories of normal people going out and discovering, oh, I can do great things. You know, I had one history class in college that I really, really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was histories through biographies.
Yeah.
So I just read people's biographies, and then you get this sense of, oh, this is just a normal person. I could go out and do something like he did. That's the way I tried to teach my daughter history. I let her read biographies of people.
And it's a shame, too, the amount of attention in history that goes to people who are basically violent sociopaths.
I know, it's all about wars and politicians.
Yeah.
That's not what I want to read about.
And they're always cast as heroes. I remember saying to, in my own family, I kind of wander into these political discussions from time to time, and I'm trying to not do that anymore, but some argument about George Bush versus Obama, and I said to them, you understand that George Bush will go down in history. This is kind of a risky thing to say, but I wouldn't be surprised, I guess, if George Bush went down in history as one of the greatest presidents, regardless of what happens in Iraq or Afghanistan. There was certainly plenty of propaganda working for him while he was doing these things. But the textbooks have a way of rewriting stories later on, in addition to the propaganda of the time, to present all people in a more favorable light. So if you look at, and people are saying, what are you talking about? George Bush was absolutely awful. And yeah, of course he was awful. But look at the other people who get carved into statues and put, and carved into mountains and put on money. Lincoln, Wilson, Roosevelt. These are sick and extremely, they were extremely dangerous people. And many of them, especially Roosevelt and Wilson, planted the seeds for a lot of the problems that, that people are dealing with today. But that's all erased from history. And like you said, the other thing that's completely erased from history is ordinary people. You know, people who thought that they could solve problems without violence.
Well, hopefully it will be us writing the history and not these propaganda.
Well, see, we have a huge advantage now because of how decentralized information is. I mean, you look at, in addition to just articles or websites on the internet, YouTube is basically cataloging the propaganda of the mainstream media in a pretty thorough and pretty reliable way. So while people like Joseph Goebbels kind of actually gets more of a pass than he deserves in history, because there is no record, there is no video, there is no audio clips of him rationalizing the violence of powerful people. But all of these mainstream media talking head pundits today, there is a very good record of them rationalizing the violence of powerful people. I think of just another Free State example, that guy Chris Matthews, who had William Kostrick on his show so he could play the role of an attack dog. Is somebody who is recorded for all of posterity as a rationalizer of violence being done by people who do not care about him. I mean, maybe they care about Chris Matthews more than they care about you and me, because Chris Matthews has a voice. But it's really, really, really shameful. And all of those people are being recorded for future generations, which I think will learn more than you or I could ever expect to learn. And I really am confident and enthusiastic and hopeful that the next generation, maybe even the kids coming through high school and middle school right now, will realize the things that we've realized in a far more expedient manner. And they won't fall for it. Hopefully the election of Obama there is the last time that that people fall for this. It might take another 4 or 8 or 12 years. But like I said, I'm hopeful about that, you know?
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of homeschooling, and those kids are growing up now. They're going to be starting to do things, and they haven't been through the indoctrination camps, so that's something to be hopeful for.
Yeah, and it only takes a small amount. I mean, if you look at the activists in Keene, and then you put them in a division problem where the activists are up top and the number of people living in Keene are in the bottom, and you get a percentage, you're talking about a very, very, very small percent of people. Mm-hmm. But look at the impact.
Yeah, they're creating quite a stir there.
So before we wrap up, Kat, what can people do to learn more about the things that you're involved in? What could people do to get more involved if they're in New Hampshire or elsewhere?
The groups I'm working with, I'm doing the New Hampshire Free Press. You can go to newhampshirefreepress.com. And I try to get ideas out there that maybe the government isn't out there to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also working with the Liberty Scholarship Fund. And that is giving out scholarships to people who want to take their kids out of the public schools. So you can get $500 to take your kid out and homeschool them or put them in a private school.
That's absolutely terrific. I actually just learned about that recently from you, I believe, and I'm surprised. I'm going to actually look into that more myself. And I have a way of putting links on my website or on the podcast page over and over and over again, kind of encouraging people to click on them. So I will definitely add that to that list. Liberty Scholarship Fund, it's called?
Yeah, lsfund.org.
Excellent.
So I really appreciate you you taking the time to speak with me, Kat. And
it was a pleasure. Thanks.
Hopefully we'll get to do it again in the near future. And thanks for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
This edition of the Ridley Report is brought to you by NewHampshireFreePress.com. New Hampshire freedom activists gathered to protest the arrest of indie reporter Sam Dodson. Weeks later, I am in jail for doing the same thing, videotaping in a courtroom lobby. As my jail stay nears its end, fellow inmates have questioned whether Free Staters are really very effective. They change their tune when they see some of these same people appearing outside the jail in large numbers. It's July 12, 2009, and 40 liberty activists swarm the jail grounds. They're there to welcome me out. Watching this spectacle from inside, one of the inmates who had questioned what we were doing says, "I gotta give y'all props." His name is Robert, and he had an interesting take on my civil disobedience. He questions civil disobedience on the ground that it triggers taxpayer expense. And at that moment, one of my controversial decisions pays off. After my arrest for videotaping in the lobby, I had announced that although I wouldn't pay any fines, I would happily serve a community service sentence. Some liberty activists questioned this approach, but I did it so that if people like Robert wanted to know why I was triggering taxpayer expense, I could tell them I wasn't. And that's exactly what I tell him. The authorities chose to put me in jail when they could have simply gotten labor out of me, or left me alone in that lobby. I don't know if this approach wins everyone over, but it seemed to win Robert over.
Kind of scruffy looking today, just got out of this jail, and to my surprise, I have a live signal here.
Now, just minutes out of jail, my camera is returned, and I'm able to begin broadcasting again.
I came out to see you. See you freed. We missed you a lot.
But the day is to become memorable for one more thing. Hours after these pictures are taken, I enter one of the Free Staters' hangouts in Keene. When I walk through the front door, there are at least 30 of us there. But I am greeted by a roar of applause that seems to sound more like 100. Of all the moving experiences I've ever had, this one is in the top 10. The harder the authorities push down on our spring, the more energy it has and the higher it flies when they let it go.
The pistol now has profit, the bullet some kind of lord and king, but pain is the only promise that the so-called savior's gonna bring. Love can be a liar, and justice can be a thief, and freedom can be an empty cup from which everybody wanna drink.